Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Next Monday is tax day. Your federal and state taxes, if you mail them, must be postmarked by midnight on Monday, unless you get an extension. Getting ready to file those taxes is a yearly ritual that many dread. Some gather up their information and take it to an accountant or to a service like H&R Block. Others use a computer program like TurboTax. But most of us make most of our money through wages. We don't have exotic investments or international business concerns or other entanglements from which we may or may not benefit at tax time. Because most of us receive W-2 income and the government automatically receives a copy of our W-2s, why do we have to jump through all these hoops? Does it really have to be this much of a hassle? Is it like this everywhere in the world? Or is this annual torture unique to the United States? We look into that and more this hour with the help of Paul Keel and Vaishali Shah. Paul Keel is a business and consumer finance reporter for ProPublica, who has contributed to and written numerous articles about the American tax system. And Vaishali Shah is a lecturer in finance at Elon University and a founder of Copperseed. That's a financial coaching firm. Welcome to you both. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Vaishali, I'm starting with you. I remember my father sitting down every year with a pencil. This is the old days, with a pencil and the paper forms and an eraser. And I don't think he had a calculator yet, but he was sitting there filling out his taxes, grumbling most of the time. And most, if not all of us, as I said, have W-2 income. His income was fundamentally W-2 income, which means the government already knew everything that he knew, except for maybe some deductions for family members and things like that. Are most people in that category?
I think that, well, I will say, first of all, I remember the days of paper and pencil tax returns as well. When I was a teenager, my father had me start filling out my own tax returns when I got my first job. So I very much remember that. I think what makes most of us do have W-2 income, I think what makes our tax situation and our tax return so complicated is the different levels of adjustments and deductions and credits. I think that's where the confusion comes in and our taxes become more complicated.
Is that why we have to fill out these forms? I mean, some people just fill out the easy form, which I haven't filled out in 100 years, so I don't remember it very well. But if you have some of these deductions, whether it's, or you have interest from bank accounts or things like that, is that why we have to sit down and fill these things out every year?
Yes, I think so. I actually had this very conversation with one of my students. He said, well, you know, we get a W-2, the government gets a copy, they get copies of our 1099s from, you know, other sources of income or investments. Why can't the government just put that information together and tell us what we owe? I think the issue is that they don't know, for example, our charitable contributions, which, you know, we can deduct even if we don't have a Schedule A deduction anymore. We can do that if we don't itemize. They don't know the level that we're putting into IRAs necessarily. There are all kinds of other items that play into this besides just what's reported from our employers.
Unless you're eligible, Paul, to file that 1040 easy form, most people have to spend time assembling materials to do their own taxes, or if they can't figure it out, they go to a tax service like H&R Block and others, or use a computer program like TurboTax or others. Is that because taxes are too complicated for the average person? They don't understand what to put in what on what line? Or is it simply because this service industry and computer software people have come up with a product that takes the load off our hands? They're filling a need that it's just easy to say, you do it.
Right. I mean, so I would say roughly half people have taxes that are so simple that the government knows about all your forms of income. What can make things a little bit more complicated is if you have children, and I'm talking about like low-income, middle-income people who have very pretty simple financial lives, because we have chosen as a country to do a lot of our sort of our welfare, you know, type programs. We have a very big anti-poverty program, the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is done through the tax code. So that's part of your filing your taxes. And for instance, like a European country, filing your taxes is very simple. And actually, I think kind of a window into that is, you know, we all pay Social Security and Medicare taxes that are payroll taxes that just come automatically out of our paychecks. We don't even think about it, but for most people, you pay more taxes through payroll taxes than you do income tax. It's completely frictionless. And the reason it's like that is because it's just automatic. There's no real adjustments or anything like that. And that is what filing taxes is like in some European countries, where you just like, I've, you know, family in the Netherlands, and literally just go on the computer and they say, this is what we have for you. Is this correct? And you're like, yes. And then you're done pretty much. But because we choose to do some of our tax credits, like, you know, our anti-poverty programs through the tax code, you know, do you have a young child living with you? Do they live with you the, you know, majority of the year? If so, then you get this tax credit that becomes part of the process. I mean, that's not massively complicated, but it is a complication. And that's one reason why we have, you know, the system.
Yeah, Vishala, you work with students at Elon University to develop what is described, at least on the website there at Elon, as quantitative and, by the way, there's a typo on the website, quantitative and qualitative aspects of personal finance. How big a role do tax considerations play in our financial lives? In other words, how big a role should they play? How much of a consideration should they be through the year?
Yeah, so I teach a class called Financial Planning, in which we investigate all areas of personal finance, including insurance, estates, tax planning, investments, any financial decision that you make, we cover. And what I say to my students is, you know, every module that we investigate, whether it's investments or estates, insurance, we should always consider the tax consequence. Tax weaves itself throughout all of these other areas. And so any financial decision that's made, anytime money is transacted, right, we can assume that there will likely be some sort of tax consequence. So I think that tax is pervasive throughout all of our financial decisions and should be a consideration.
I mean, for young people who really are just starting their financial lives, who don't really have a lot of money yet and have not reached their peak earning years, is a good way of considering the time we spend putting together our 1040s, just a moment in time where we take stock of where we are financially? Is that a good way to think about it?
I think that's a good way to think about it. I think, you know, early on in life, our taxes are fairly simple. We can probably complete them on our own. As you said, typically most of our income is through earned income wages at that point. I think great consideration is to start thinking about retirement planning at that early age. So 401k access, IRAs, health savings accounts, you know, these are great vehicles to be using early on that have tax consequences, you know, because contributions are often deductible. And so that definitely plays into our tax consequence, but also our overall financial health.
But unless you have a class like yours, unless you go to a tax preparer, be they an accountant or an H&R Block or whoever, how do you know all these considerations? How do you know I should maybe put my money in a Roth and not a traditional IRA? How do you know that?
It's so hard. It is so hard because our system is so complicated. You know, as I was preparing for this conversation today, I thought, what advice would I give people? You know, and the number one piece of advice is, like we just talked about, assume that there's a tax consequence to any financial transaction and be curious and ask the questions. You know, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do. For those of us who have tax preparers, I encourage you to ask your tax preparer after your tax return is filed to go through that tax form with you and explain each line item and really try to understand what that means. There are programs out there that offer education in tax. I will say it's not an easy task by any means to learn all the different tax consequences of our financial decisions.
Like so much of what we're discovering about America in recent years, there's a difference between rich and poor, and the considerations between rich and poor. Paul Keel with ProPublica was on this program about a year ago. And Paul, when you were here last year, one of the things that we talked about was how Congress has placed a lot of breaks and offsets in the tax code that can really only be accessed by or taken advantage of by the rich or by businesses, under the logic that what's good for business is good for the economy. And I asked you whether that was true. I have forgotten your answer, so tell me what it is. What's the truth there?
Well, it's actually a really hard thing to study. So like there was recently a study, you know, Trump had this big tax cut in 2017. And so economists were like trying to establish, you know, a lot of it was a big corporate rate cut for corporations and a lot of incentives for them to invest, a lot of breaks for doing so. And, you know, if you give businesses a lot of money, they will use some of that money to, you know, invest in buy, you know, new equipment and drive growth. But it's a lot of debate over like how much, what percentage of that is, you know,
but wouldn't they do that anyway if they needed to remain competitive? Wouldn't you invest in research and development and new equipment because the other guy's doing it?
This is the argument that, I mean, this goes back a century, essentially, like, you know, what sort of rate should there be on corporations and how should you tax them? I mean, and then debate of like when you cut rates for corporations, who benefits from that? I think consensus has settled more in terms of like the wealthy, you know, executives at these corporations will see higher salaries. Those things will definitely happen. And maybe some of it does, you know, trickle down, but obviously there's a lot of skepticism about how much.
President Biden has claimed that 1,000 American billionaires pay an average tax rate of 8.2%. which is far less, percentage-wise at least, than many less wealthy individuals. And he wants to boost that to a maximum or a minimum tax rate of 25%, while emphasizing that no one earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in federal taxes. Are his figures accurate?
So I believe he did that after. So we did the story. We received a large, you know, leak of information for the wealthiest Americans, tax information, and looked at, you know, some of the wealthiest people in America, like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Warren Buffett, and looked at, you know, how much richer did they get over a 5-year period and how much taxes did they pay in that period. And because our system does not tax, you know, it defines income rather narrowly, which is, you know, if you get $100 billion richer from, you know, Jeff Bezos's stock in Amazon, but he sells only a small portion of that. He's only taxed on what he sells, even though he got $100 billion richer. This is like sort of a main part of our tax code that is people have been aware of, for a century, but it's the reason why, you know, the tax rate for people like Bezos, how much taxes they pay is so small relative to how wealthy they are. And so that's the 8% number. So Biden's Treasury Department, after we did our story, because we found the top 25 actually had a tax rate, if you looked at how much richer did they get versus how much taxes did they pay, it was 4% was our number over a 5-year period. They looked at a larger set based on, you know, large anonymous block information that came with the 8% number. I mean, it just comes down to, you know, this system is very good at taxing labor income, wage income, with a lot of breaks for businesses. So business income can be pretty squishy, and the most squishy is investment income, particularly, you know, things like stocks that you can control when you have income and how you have the income.
And Warren Buffett has said he doesn't pay enough in income taxes, which is an interesting thing for a billionaire to say. I want to do a follow-up on whether President Biden's solution would throw things out of whack or whether it would balance all of this, and we'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Paul Keel has joined us. He's a business and consumer finance reporter for ProPublica. And Vaishali Shah is a lecturer in finance at Elon University and founder of Copperseed. That's a financial coaching a firm. We'll talk more about that in a moment. I mentioned just before the break, and we were talking just before the break, about President Biden claiming that 1,000 American billionaires pay an average of 8.2%, which is far less in income taxes than the average person pays. And ProPublica's investigation, you say, turned up they pay really more like 4%. So would raising taxes on billionaires and capping any increase in taxes at anybody making $400,000 or more, would that put the system into some sort of better balance? Would it balance the tax code more fairly, or would it stress the economy in some way?
I mean, there's arguments. There's certainly arguments against the idea. I mean, we were talking earlier about why is our tax code so complicated. So back in the 1960s, the Treasury Department did a report that found like a bunch of millionaires weren't paying any taxes. And that led to the alternative minimum tax, which I describe as, you know, when we like don't like the answer in terms of like a millionaire does their taxes, they don't owe any taxes. The alternative minimum tax is like, okay, do it again, but a little bit differently this time. And we'll see if the answer is like makes more sense. So we've had that forever. That's another layer of complexity. What Biden has proposed is basically a billionaire minimum tax, which would, you know, try to solve for this problem of, you know, we don't tax gains until they're sold. So yes, that would attack that problem. There are issues with that. Like, for instance, what if your wealth is in a business that's not publicly traded? And so are we going to force someone to like value their business and sell a portion of their business? And so they get around that by basically saying that, no, you can hold on to it, but eventually you're going to have to sell, you know, at the end of your life, maybe. It gets hairy, but it does get at that one kind of root problem of we don't tax unrealized gains. But it would layer another, you know, layer of complexity on our already complex system. For sure.
For people who don't know, unrealized gains, if you invest in something and the value of it goes up, as long as you don't sell it, yes, you are technically on paper richer because you have a gain in that stock, but you don't pay taxes on that gain until you go to sell it. And that's the difference there. From a financial point of view, a financial health point of view, Vishali, would President Biden's prescription for taxing billionaires at a more equitable rate, in his opinion, would that do damage to the economy? Would it be a good idea? Would the country benefit in some way financially? Would the financial burden on the average person decrease?
Right. Well, that's a very complex question, right? Because I think part of what we would be doing is we would be shifting when those taxes are collected. So as opposed to collecting the taxes at the point of sale, or potentially there could be a loss that's claimed at the point of sale, we'd be taxing that changing value at regular intervals over time, right? Which spreads out when that tax is collected or that loss is claimed. I would say, does it decrease the burden? Our policies very much affect like spending and revenue generation, right? So there's got to be a balance between the money that we're bringing in and the money that we're spending. So,
and we do have this perennial seesaw argument back and forth. Republicans generally like to cut taxes, particularly on businesses, and to keep taxes low for high-income individuals. Democrats, particularly President Biden, say they want to cut taxes for average-income Americans and make sure that high-income individuals and businesses pay, quote, their fair share. Is the tax system, Vishali, weighted in one way or the other? Is it unfairly weighted?
I think that the burden does fall very much on low income earners, especially those who are earning income, right? Because we are heavily taxing earned income as opposed to capital gains. So if you own an investment and you own it for the long term, and then you sell it, the tax on that profit is lower than an average person would pay on the income that they earn.
Yeah, so the income earned from investors is taxed at a different rate than income that you earn through W-2s. And if you lose money on an investment, you can write that off, can't you?
You can. You can take that deduction over time, yes.
You and your colleagues, Paul, at ProPublica spent a lot of time scrutinizing tax information from thousands of the wealthiest Americans, and you did see this chasm between their reality and that of the average person, and you published some of what you found in an article called "If You're Getting a W-2, You're a Sucker." You pointed out that those who don't rely on income earned, which is what we're talking about, income earned from wages, essentially face a completely different tax structure. And you used the comparison, I think, in that story of two people making $1 million, but they make it in different ways. One person earned $1 million in W-2 income, and the other person earned $1 million in through their business or through investments. What's the difference there?
Well, we also did a story. I think one of the clearest examples of this is sports teams. So we gave the example of, like, you know, LeBron James and then the owner of the Clippers. We, like, the scene was like the Clippers versus Lakers game. So and a stadium worker there. So the stadium worker there was paying a relatively low income tax rate, but still paying payroll tax. And if you kind of balance in, you know, someone in that level, you know, earning $20,000 a year or something like that is going to pay much more in payroll tax than income tax. But that's still a considerable burden for them. You know, payroll tax is 15%, just based on what comes out of your employer and also your paycheck. LeBron James earns his money through, you know, at this stage of his career, like endorsements and wages. That's, you know, taxed at the highest rate. So he's paying an income tax rate that's as high as 40% when you include everything. And then if you buy a sports franchise, there's this crazy thing in our tax code where you actually can, you basically depreciate it, where, like, you know, you buy it for $1 billion, you get to write it off a little bit every year, as if it's losing value, which it's not, but we just treat it as if it is. So it's basically a giant tax write-off. So it helps to decrease the tax burden for Steve Ballmer, who's someone who's, like, you know, has vast amounts of Microsoft stock, and is paying a relatively low tax rate. Somewhat, actually, if you look at what their tax rates are, it's like kind of similar to what the stadium workers paying, you include the payroll tax.
I mean, the argument could be made that when you make an investment, which is taxed at a different rate than income, if there's a profit on that investment, when you make that investment, you are taking a risk. It is a gamble. You may lose, you may win, you may stay the same. If you buy a lottery ticket, if you go on to your phone and use a sports betting app and you win big, that's taxed as ordinary income, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, it's income, yeah.
Why should it be? It's the same risk.
You're saying if you buy something and you hold on to it and you don't sell it and then it improves in value. That's the realization rule that we have. There is, like, some subtleties about how we tax personal incomes. I mean, like, gambling losses you can only use to offset gambling winnings, or you can't use that as a giant write-off if your lottery ticket habit doesn't go well, to help you lower your taxes on your wages.
Vaishali, I know you want to chime in on this idea about depreciation. I want to share an anecdotal story before you do that, because years ago I was in management at a radio station, and we were laying off people because things weren't going well. But that same day that I fired 10% of the staff, I was told to go out and buy a new van for the station. And I said, why? He said, the general manager said, because vans are a depreciable asset. People are not. I was a young person. It confounded me. Talk about depreciation and how that works in the tax code.
So I think this is another layer of complexity, right? I mean, we keep talking about different things that make our tax system more complex. When that van was purchased, for example, or if someone purchases property for rental purposes, they depreciate that, right? So they're taking a deduction based on the annual lifetime value of that item, right? But it also decreases what we call basis. So if the van was purchased for $100,000 and $5,000 was depreciated that first year, that that purchase price, if you will, is reduced to $95,000. So that when that van is sold, now instead of taking the sales price and deducting $100,000 for profit purposes, we're subtracting $95,000, right? So we're at the point where we then sell that asset, we are declaring more of a gain, because we've taken a depreciation to begin with. So I still do feel that because that asset is taxed at a different rate, the capital gains rate, as opposed to the earned income rate, there's definitely a difference. But that's just another level of complexity.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's a good example of what I wanted to talk about anyway, and that is there are these things built into the tax code that on the surface look unfair or like you're cheating, but you're not, because it's legal to do it, and you would be foolish not to take advantage of some of these breaks in the tax code. But is that the way it should be, or should there be this level playing field for Shali?
I think it should be more simple, to be honest. I mean, the ultimate reason for taxes, right? Like, well, two main reasons. Originally, the reason is just to raise money to run the government, to provide services. Also, you know, fiscal policy is used to influence the economy, you know, rein in inflation and things like that. We use the tax code now to influence behavior, right? Incentives to save for retirement, for healthcare expenses, for education, such like that. But I think that the actual raising of funds to run the government can be a very simple process. It doesn't have to be so complicated.
She brings up incentives, Paul, and there are people on the right who are upset that there are incentives, monetary incentives, to buy an electric vehicle because of this push toward a greener economy. Should the tax code be used to incentivize people's behavior?
Yeah, it's just a matter of, you know, they want to subsidize these purchases because of, you know, climate change, and the tax code is a ready vehicle for doing that. It, you know, it works well. There's, you know, we've developed a system that accounts for this over the years, and so it's like a go-to, like this, it'll work this way essentially. Like, you could do it a different way. You could do it through the dealers, and the dealers get to write it off immediately, and we send money to the dealers. That's another way to do it. It just, this is the way we do it. But it does make things obviously more complicated when you do taxes. But I guess from a DC perspective, we know this works. Taxes are complicated anyway. Like, what's one more tax credit? Let's just do it this way.
The Trump administration. Did you want to comment, Vaishali?
Yes, and I want to support that comment as well. I think it makes these incentives make taxes and the system of creating your tax return and submitting it complex for the individual, right? It makes it a little simpler for the government because they're giving refunds and they're collecting revenue through the Department of the Treasury. It's one system. And so it's simpler for the government. It's more complex for the individual.
During the Trump administration, there were tax cuts. The critical parts of that 2017 federal tax law, which reduced taxes for average Americans, are set to expire. This is a little way off, but still, it's coming up. It's looming. December 31st, 2025, these tax cuts will expire. They're in place today, but were there any changes in this current tax year or the one that we're filing for now, 2023, that taxpayers, Paul, should be aware of?
Well, there's a bill that didn't make it that's still in the Hill. So I would say no, and obviously it can be corrected on this, but there still may be a bill passed, and then what would they would do? It could lead to a little bit more of a break for people who have kids in terms of the child tax credit. There's a lot of business tax breaks in there, but Republicans in the Senate don't like the child tax credit part of it. And so it seems like it might die, so it might not. But if it did pass, they would actually send people like extra money. You would get it automatically. You wouldn't have to redo your taxes or anything like that.
So these tax cuts from 2017, Vaishali, that are set to expire on December 31st, 2025, that may not happen because if Donald Trump is reelected president, he will most likely keep those tax cuts in place or improve on them, in his opinion. But if he's not reelected, they will probably be allowed to expire. Are there things that taxpayers should be thinking about, planning for now, 18 months out, to get ready for a reset that might see the highest tax rate go from 37% to 39.6%, or for standard deductions to be reduced if that ends up being the case?
I think that the biggest change that we should be looking for is the reduction in the standard deduction. As you said, more individuals will be itemizing again. So for those of us who bought homes in the last couple of years and have a very high mortgage interest rate, we might start seeing the benefit of itemizing and taking that as a deduction as opposed to the standard deduction. So there's going to be a difference in the level of tax that we're paying because of the offset of moving from a very high standard deduction now to potentially itemizing. So the difference between that as a consequence on our ultimate tax.
So I would think you shouldn't be changing your behavior because we don't know what's going to happen. Nothing is going to happen at the moment for the next 18 months. But should these things be percolating in the back of your head? If you're going to make, if you're going to buy a house, for instance, in the next 18 months, should those thoughts be going through your mind?
You know, I think with the uncertainty of how this will play out, I think that some of these purchases, like buying a house, is so much more bigger than just the tax consequence. I encourage everyone to take stock of their larger financial picture and see how some of these strategies, buying a home versus renting, how it fits into your lifestyle, your long-term decisions. That's more important, I think, than the tax consequence at this point.
Paul, I only have a minute left in this segment, and we'll talk more about this when we come back from the break. But you at ProPublica worked on this investigation called the TurboTax trap. Intuit, the company that makes TurboTax, evidently worked against making tax preparation easier and less costly. But before we talk about that, let me ask you this. Does the average person need TurboTax or any other tax program to do their taxes?
I would say a good portion of people shouldn't need it, but I understand why people go to it, and we can talk about why we have that system after the
break,
I guess.
We'll come back and talk about that, because this was evidently a 20-year fight to stop the simplification of the tax system put on by TurboTax and others. Paul Keel is a business and consumer finance reporter with ProPublica. Vaishali Shah is a lecturer in finance at Elon University and founder of Copperseed, that's a financial coaching firm. We're coming right back with more about tax time, which is next Monday, by the way, in case you haven't forgotten it. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Paul Keel is here with us from ProPublica, and Vaishali Shah from Elon University. We're talking about taxes, the American tax system, tax code in advance of tax day next Monday. And we were just talking before the break about ProPublica's investigation into TurboTax and their 20-year effort to stop Americans from filing their taxes for free or simplifying the tax code. And that report was published 2 years ago. One of the things you uncovered was that, and the fact also that they were told to stop what was called years of widespread deceptive advertising about doing tax filing for free using their software. Talk about all of that, Paul.
Yeah, so I mean, you go way back to the 90s. I don't know if people, you know, remember, you know, TurboTax being the CD-ROM thing that you would buy and do at home on your desktop computer. And starting in the early 2000s, they started transitioning to online. But even during the Bush administration, this is 20 years ago, you know, the internet was this new exciting thing, and everyone's like, we can do all these government services online, it'd be so much more efficient. And so Bush's, you know, Treasury Department started looking into the idea of, well, at least for, you know, low-income people, we could do an easy online, you know, filing thing. It's not rocket science. This alarmed TurboTax, which even then, you know, was, you know, not as many people were doing their taxes online back then, but they had a very large portion of people who were doing it by themselves, doing like DIY software. And, you know, they had some very capable lobbyists and essentially stopped this process, stopped the government from building something, and came to this agreement. They started this program called Free File. And basically the agreement was, you, the government, will not build anything, and will actually say that in a contract. The IRS is not going to build, like, you know, your own system to build to have people file their taxes for free. But in exchange for that, tax preparers like, you know, TurboTax, like H&R Block, will provide a free service for low-income people to file their taxes online. And that there was sort of like a treaty or something like that. And so that system started, and what it, you know, it actually drew like a fair number of people, like, you know, in the millions, but low millions, which in terms of the number of people filing taxes is not that large, but it did, it became popular enough because one of the tax preparers, Tax Act, actually, you know, found that they could actually gain a lot of customers through this program. And so they made it actually very easy to qualify for it and alarm TurboTax. And essentially, you know, Intuit's lobbyists, the company that owns TurboTax, convinced the Treasury to kind of make it a little not as easy to qualify for the program. But I think through that program, TurboTax discovered that people really like the idea of filing their taxes for free. And that's when you start seeing them advertise their free edition online, which is, you know, it says, everyone's seen these ads, you know, free, free, free. And basically the way it works is they advertise, you can file your taxes for free. It's just that a lot of people don't run the gauntlet. What causes them not to file for free is they have a form that's not covered by the free program. It could be something as simple as you have unemployment income in the prior year, or you have a student loan interest. There's things that do pop up fairly frequently for even, you know, middle or low income people. So after we published our stories, the FTC sued Intuit. And they did come to this decision that they need to change their way that they advertise. So now if you see their advertisements for free, they now have to say, actually, most people won't be able to file for free. So you'll see like free, and then it'll say actually 37% of people will qualify for free. That's sort of that's what the FTC made them do.
But, you know, TurboTax has been around for a while. H&R Block has a program, plus they have their own tax preparing firm with offices scattered all over the country, so you can go in there and file your returns without having to hire your own personal accountant. But you can, your accountant will likely file your taxes with the IRS and with your state tax division electronically. Why can't we? Why doesn't the IRS simply develop its own program? You go online to irs.gov and you start filling out your taxes directly online. They have this thing now called Direct File, which I think is a pilot program in 12 states, both in English and Spanish. Why do they have to have a pilot program? TurboTax has been doing this for 25 years.
Right. So the reason is this deal made back in the Bush administration, basically the IRS agreed to stand down in return for this free file program.
Why? Why would we do that? Why would a government agency, which is in charge of collecting taxes and keeping track of all this, have to capitulate to TurboTax of all people, to Intuit?
Yeah, these are good questions. I think the lobbyists made a convincing case on Capitol Hill. I mean, Republicans have been hostile to this idea. You hear this argument like, you don't want the IRS preparing your taxes and also auditing you. But the thing is, for like a very large portion of people, I would say like half of taxpayers, there are not two ways to do your taxes. Like, it's, you have W-2 income, you know, your kid lived with you a certain number of, you know, if you have a business, that starts to be like gray areas. But for a lot of people, it's really not that complicated. But this argument that you don't want the government preparing your taxes because they're going to screw you, it's a nonsense argument, but it sounds reasonable to people.
I mean, they're going to screw you by using the, if they, they're not going to screw you, they're going to use the laws on the books. Vishali, go ahead.
Right.
Well, and I was going to say, short of the government preparing your tax return, there's really no reason that we couldn't go online and fill out our own tax return the way we would if it were paper or through TurboTax or whatever, and then just submit it. Like, this should be an easy process.
Yes.
And we should be able to do it directly.
Well, that's what they do in Japan and in Germany and New Zealand. If they can do it there, why can't we do it here? And would it make life easier, or would it just be another thing we have to use the computer for?
So personally, I think it would make life easier. I think You know, clients that I work with that use, for example, TurboTax and such, I think that these programs actually cause more confusion because you're putting numbers into boxes. These numbers mean different things and can be reported in different ways or should be reported in different ways. There's so many nuances that it is a complicated system. And when we're just putting numbers in boxes without full understanding of what these numbers mean or the impact, that leads to a lot of errors. Well, and
well, talk to me about that, because even if you sit down with a pencil and paper and fill out your 1040 the old-fashioned way, you're still putting numbers into boxes. And one of the things that confuses people is that they don't know necessarily precisely what goes in those boxes, what constitutes X, that the IRS says, put your X income here. Well, is that this and this or just that? You don't know what to put in that box, whether you use a computer program or not. That speaks to the complexity of all this, doesn't it?
I agree. I agree completely. I think that when we are filling out the forms ourselves instead of using the, you know, the boxes and the flow chart that TurboTax provides, we have a better opportunity of going straight to the workbooks and things and reading the information that the IRS provides to determine what goes where. And I think that just leads to a high level of education about our tax and understanding of how much we're reporting, how much tax we're paying. I'm not saying it's not complicated. I'm just saying that the simplicity of a program like TurboTax actually makes it more confusing.
Paul, you mentioned that Republicans don't were influenced by these lobbyists, and they don't. Why would you let the IRS fill out your taxes for you? They're going to cheat you, and that does speak to the difference of opinion about taxes among Republicans and Democrats. But is that it? I mean, is there something fundamentally wrong with allowing the government to have its own website where you go in every year and you put your numbers in and you're done?
I mean, it comes down to it has always seen this as a great threat. And one reason is
because it a threat?
Well, they would like everyone who has to file their taxes to go through them. So yeah, it is a threat in terms of, but you know, the program was never gonna do the taxes of people who have their own business. So, you know, the direct file is pretty limited in terms of who qualifies. Essentially, you have to be someone who's a very simple, you know, situation. You have a W-2 income, maybe you have a little interest income in your bank account. That's who it's designed for. And I think that's all it's who it's ever gonna reach. I mean, that would be tens of millions of people, but it still, you know, the business owner is never going to be able to file their taxes through the IRS. I think that's pretty clear. But one thing that may happen, because you know the IRS received like a very large sum of money, right, $80 billion in the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, a lot of that is to go to auditing, you know, the rich, but a lot of it's just to improve the systems of the IRS, which have been kind of pathetically, you know, dilapidated for decades now. So one thing they have not been able to do that hopefully they say they should be able to do in the next year or two is, you know, you have a W-2, right? Your employer sends your W-2 to the IRS. The IRS now has no way to like turn that around and like show you your W-2 or to send that to whatever you're using to fill out your taxes. You have to like peck it in usually. But pretty soon, like in the next two years or so, they should be able to have the software to like to show you that or to fill it in automatically. So yeah. You know, TurboTax does that because they have a deal with like your payroll company or whatever, but that should be available for all tax preparers and other forms of software, which would be competition to TurboTax because that's one of their competitive advantages is that they have these deals with payroll on companies right now.
The idea that we don't know what to put in which box, Vishali, is that because of insufficient financial education? I mean, should we all take your class? If we did, would we know? Or is it because the tax code is just too, it's like speaking Greek to people who speak English?
You know, when in my financial planning class, when I teach my students, and we're talking about retirement accounts, IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, I say to them, anytime you make a decision about one of these accounts or your counseling clients, reread the code, like reread the rules, because the rules are so complex. Regarding anything tax related, I always say reread it, you know, and because there's so many details that can be missed, and it's because the system is complex.
So if you want to be on the safe side, if you want to get everything that's coming to you and pay the least amount you have to pay, are you wise to hire somebody whose job it is to read the changes in the tax code and understand them? In other words, are you wise to go to a professional?
I think at a certain level of complexity, I think you are wise to go to a professional. I think if you have any sort of side business or you are self-employed, you should be using a tax professional. Because it's very, very complicated beyond just earned income. I did have one thought about direct filing with the IRS. I feel like there's a value in giving people choice. So perhaps those of us who want to file a tax return, could a system be developed such that if we wanted to give the IRS our numbers, have them calculate the numbers, and then direct file that way, we should be able to, right? Make it simple for those of us who want to work directly with the IRS electronically. And for those who choose to do it differently, they can use the system they've been using, right? But at least there's some sort of choice involved there.
Is there any way to calculate the amount of money the average American is leaving on the table because they don't understand the tax code and they're not applying for the deductions, or they put the wrong thing in the wrong box? Or is there any way to calculate the amount of money the government is losing because we put the wrong thing in the wrong box and they don't question it?
There's two different numbers. Like, one, there's a lot of people who leave money on the table because they don't file. So they'll have their wages withheld, and then they actually, usually, you know, businesses over withhold, and then they don't file their taxes, so they never get their refund. And that's in the billions of dollars. And that's kind of a campaign that the IRS has occasionally tried in terms of education campaign or advertising. Like, it's, even if you don't actually owe taxes, it's often worthwhile to file just to get that refund. On the other end, there's something called the tax gap, which is, you know, the study that the IRS does occasionally. I mean, the big finding from that is, you know, looking at, you know, how much tax is collected versus how much should be collected. And it's a massive number. It's like over $600 billion. What that finds is when the government has information returns, so like W-2, the amount of money that's underreported, the amount of income that's underreported is like 1%, or it's, you know, because the IRS knows about everything, they've been told about it. Right. And the extent to which you have forms of income that are less reported, so, you know, you own a cash business, or, you know, there's forms of, you know, partnership, like complicated partnerships, that sort of stuff is hard for the IRS to track. There's more slippage. There's more, you know, ways of underpaying, and that's kind of a main finding, is that the more it's reported to the government, the more they know about, the more you're less likely to cheat.
I don't know which one of you to ask this question, but this whole thing with cryptocurrency now, and one of the attractive things about cryptocurrency is that it's untraceable. So if you're making money on crypto, does the government know it if you don't report it?
They're still working on forcing some sort of information reporting. There is a question now on taxes, like, do you have, like, they don't say cryptocurrency, they say like digital assets or something like that. So you have to say yes or no. If you say no and you do have it, that's bad news if they find out that you do have it. So that's one way they're trying to get at it in the short term. But in the long term, they should have something like, you know, when you sell stock, there's a form called the 1099B that the government gets. There should be like something like that in the future, but I don't think it's quite set up yet.
If you owe taxes, the IRS expects payment on April the 15th. So does the state of North Carolina. If you are owed money, Vishali, how long might it take this year to get that money in your bank account from the IRS or the state? Do you know?
Well, from the IRS perspective, it's actually not taking very long at all. Just, you know, a few days, a week or so to get that direct deposit in. I'm not familiar with how long it's taking the state right now to issue their refunds.
So tax day is Monday. Midnight is the filing deadline. So get it done if you haven't gotten it done yet. Vishali Shaw is a lecturer in finance and at Elon University and founder of Copperseed, a financial coaching firm. And Paul Keel is a business and consumer finance reporter with ProPublica. Thank you both for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.